Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Schwartz, who has a book, Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality, a memoir. John Schwartz works at the New York Times, has written about politics, science, recent topics, the levees in New Orleans, global climate change, worked previously for The Washington Post and Newsweek. This book, Oddly Normal, though, is very different. It's not about the New York Times, except in terms of how it relates to the story. It's a story of your son, Joseph, who is now 16 years old. You knew he was gay before he did, and you wrote this memoir. Did Joseph vet the memoir?
Joseph has been involved with the memoir from the start. When we thought about writing it, my wife and I discussed it for a long time, and when I thought I might write up a proposal, took Joe out on, some drive to get him somewhere. And while we were driving, I said, I'm thinking of writing a book about you, about us. And I described a little bit. He said, I think you should do it. And I said, some of it's going to be hard. And he said, do it. So he was there from the start and then read the manuscript the day it was done, had suggestions, recommendations, complaints. We discussed them. I incorporated some of this. And then, most important, Joe wrote a children's book as a class assignment. And when it was done, my wife, who had been involved with every step of the process, said to him, that ought to be in the book. And Joseph said to me, that ought to be in the book. And I read it, and I cried. And I said, that ought to be in the book. And so it now is. Joseph, yes, he's involved.
In the book, you go into some research regarding the history of gay life in America, what gay people have had to go through over the years, gay suicide, which we'll go into in a minute, and all of those different issues. How familiar were you with them when you sat down to write the book, or was that research that you did the kind of research you would do for an article?
Some of these are issues that I've been covering in various ways for years. As a science reporter for the Times for 6 years, I covered a lot of topics about research, though not much specifically in this area. At the same time, in the last 3 years, I was the national legal correspondent for the paper and was writing a tremendous amount about Proposition 8, same-sex marriage, Defense of Marriage Act, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell rule. And so in a lot of ways, the things that I write about in the book are things that I've researched, but not specifically for something like this. So I went far deeper than I ever had before, but many of the topics were familiar.
What did Joseph think about some of that research? Was it new material for him?
He didn't have much to say about it. I think that he's interested in everything, reads everything, but he didn't say anything specifically about the fact chapters, what we're calling the fact chapters of the book.
What's most alarming to me is that until Joseph reached high school, gender sexuality, as opposed to having sex sexuality, is completely ignored. You make the point that in middle school, no one wants to talk about it.
Well, that's right. It is, for reasons that we still don't understand, uncomfortable. Joe was a different kid in many ways. In some of the ways that he was different, he's got a little bit of a learning disability. He has trouble writing. The schools were all over that, wanted to talk about that, ready to deal with that. But a great source of stress in his life, which we felt was being gay and not being out and living with being different in that way, nobody wanted to talk about.
When he was growing up, you kind of knew that he was probably gay.
The feather boas were a clue. Joe was a wonderfully sweet little boy who loved clothes. And if it was a choice between a pair of rugged tennis shoes, for a little toddler and something pink with light up lights, he wanted the pink. That doesn't tell you 100% that a child is going to grow up to be gay, but it's a clue. And the clues stack up over time.
At that point, how much did he know?
Joe has told us that he figured out before he was 10 that he was probably gay because while he was online, he discovered to his surprise that boys like girls. So Joe grew up, and it was only at this later time that he realized that he was the one who was different. But he always knew who he was.
See, when I was growing up, there were all sorts of stories about, it's going to be a phase. So I'm sitting there going, okay, when am I going to turn straight? And finally, at 14 or 15, I realize all my friends are, but not me.
And in Joe's case, you know, we were open to the idea that we might be picking up clues that would simply fade away. Or, you know, you're not charting the kid's direction, you're watching him. But in fact, Joe stayed on the same direction the whole way.
There are so many different areas in terms of his schooling. It was very alarming to read about the misdiagnoses of ADHD, Asperger's, autism. I mean, an entire spectrum, and spectrum itself, right? But an entire range of problems that didn't exist or barely existed.
Well, the deal, it seems, is that a kid who is different and a kid who is a handful, and Joe was a handful in school, he didn't pay attention. He, if pushed, he would push back. He had anger. That if a kid causes trouble, we tend to look for a diagnosis instead of just saying, well, this kid's squirrely. I think that some of these diagnoses can be very helpful, especially in helping identify a real problem that someone has. But we tend to be quick to apply diagnoses to people who maybe they shouldn't be applied to. And Joe, to us, was one of those kids. He was socially awkward, and he had problems dealing with other kids, and there were struggles with teachers. But it didn't, at least to us, fall into one of these diagnostic categories.
Well, there was a certain point where somebody would say, okay, he's got Asperger's, and you'd go, forget it, we're leaving the office. I mean, you knew more than they did.
Right. And while we were studying diagnoses as they would come up, you know, sometimes teachers would offer them. Well, they're offering them, in effect, thinking they're being helpful, without any real clinical background, without any foundation for it. They've seen a lot of kids. And so we went through so many diagnoses with Joe, and we would go home and we would say, well, what is this supposed to be? And does Joe fit this? And again, applying what they knew to what we knew, and what we knew was Joe, we'd say, doesn't fit. Or if you can stretch this definition to fit Joe, the definition has no meaning.
John Schwartz, on top of that, he had, I guess, the fourth grade teacher from hell. This teacher was a bully.
He was a bully. He always bullied kids. I mean, every year there were a couple of kids that he picked out. We discovered more of this as the year progressed. These were kids who tended to be different, never really got a sense of what these kids, what it was in an individual kid that sparked him. But in Oddly Normal, we talk about the fact that this teacher picked Joe his year in fourth grade and focused on him and really bore down on him, thought of him, as he told me, as a project for the year. And, you know, God save you from being somebody's project.
Well, you'd also been sort of warned by your older son.
Right. Sammy, who is now 22, said, you know, he yells a lot and had not been impressed with him when he'd had him. So we were worried, but he turned out to be far worse than we'd expected. And part of the reason, to be fair, was that he was very sick. And part of the reason, to be fair, was that Joseph was a lot of trouble that year. That the more he pressed Joe, the harder Joe pushed back. And there's no room for power struggles in a classroom anyway. But whatever abilities this man had as a teacher in years past, they had really been eroded away by his illness. And so he didn't have the patience. And the good things had really worn down. And what you were left with was a really angry guy who took a lot of it out on Joe.
And at the same time, the principal wouldn't let you take Joe out and move him elsewhere.
Right. The principal was one of these people who was very calm, very pleasant, and unmoving. You couldn't budge him.
Again, comparing to when I was a kid, we didn't have a school counselor that we could go to. If I was beat up, I was beat up. I grew up in a nice neighborhood in North Queens. Joseph grows up in a nice neighborhood in Jersey. But we didn't have the access to knowledge that you did, and in the end, we turned out okay. I mean, so from that perspective, Joe had a lot of advantages that I didn't have.
You'd hope so. We know that the majority of kids report being bullied at some time or another, whether by fellow students or teachers. We know that adolescence is miserable, and younger years can be miserable. And we know that each of us carries some burden, right? I was short. I was the smallest kid in my school. I mean, I was really short, and people made fun of it, and I didn't like it, but I made it through that. You know, so we all make it through these things if things work out right. And Joe comes to it with services in the school to help, you know, whether it's counseling or speech therapy. There's much more than we have. There's a law, the IDEA, which applies to any disabilities that come up. And there's a whole lot of medicine and science devoted to dealing with whatever issues you have. Joe turned out, as I said, to have trouble writing. Well, we're in the 21st century. We bought him a laptop. His fingers fly on the laptop, and the problem is largely solved. I don't know what would happen if I'd been a kid with that problem, with that struggle to get something from my brain onto a piece of paper. But there wasn't any laptop for me. I'm old.
At the same time, I mean, he's also in Jersey. You were in Galveston. Galveston is not northern New Jersey.
It is not. It was a great place to grow up, but it was, you know, Texas in the 1950s and 60s, and it was a good town in many ways, but I was little, I was different, I was lippy, and I got pounded a little bit.
John Schwartz, what do you think about the use of Ritalin or its successors, all of these kids taking these drugs these days?
Well, the first thing you've got to understand is I have friends whose kids have been put on medication, who had serious problems, and who were transformed for the better by the judicious use of medication. So I've got no, you know, rigid anti-medication stance, but I think that the key word is judicious. It has to be tied to something that is really clear, and it has to be done with full discussion all around. In our case, we were really reluctant to engage in any of this medication business early when Joe was causing trouble in the classroom, because we really felt that if he was with a different teacher, if this were different, if that were different, then he wouldn't be kicking up as much. And in fact, from year to year, we saw that. Good teacher, good year. Bad teacher, bad year. And Joe was consistently Joe throughout. Medication wasn't going to change the teacher. You know, and he had great teachers. And
right.
He was great those years. So to us, it didn't seem a problem that you needed to fix that way. And yet, later, when Joe was really seriously depressed, and when Joe tried to take his life, yeah, they offered medication. We said, yeah, we need to do that now.
Was the aftermath of that the reason you chose to write the book? I mean, if he hadn't tried to kill himself, would it have made a sufficient impression on you to write the book?
I think that we wouldn't have had as much to say. This was such a shocking thing for us that we had to rethink everything Gene and I had done since he was born. And we had to look all along the way, and we had to find ways to help Joe at that point. A simpler and happier life might not have led us to do as much self-examination or research to move things forward. And that's the subject of the book. Gene and I don't portray ourselves as heroic in this. We explain the things we did along the way where we screwed up. And we did.
John and I have known each other on the well for about 20 years, but we've never met until about 20 minutes ago or a half hour ago. We've known each other for these 20 years. And at one point I said to him online, I said, you know, you're a good parent. And you said, no, we're just trying not to be bad parents. And that's how you feel.
It is, because, you know, the great headline from The Onion, every type of parenting leads to miserable children. There are so many ways to mess this up. And yet we all, if we're lucky, if things work out, we all muddle through. So you want to be that parent that doesn't mess things up.
When you say we messed up, which you say, where did you mess up? I read the book and I couldn't see a mess up. I'm sorry.
I think that we missed many signs that would have shown us how serious Joe's depression was. I think we missed signs along the way that he had really tough impulses to hurt himself. In retrospect, they stood out. Along the way, it was all part of the mix of our daily lives. I'm not trying to, you know, put myself in daddy jail here. I'm just saying that we clearly were not perfect. We didn't, you know, we didn't do everything right. There's I think a tendency towards self-congratulation, especially when you're writing about yourself. And it's really not us. You know, if we'd done everything right, Joe wouldn't have ended up in the hospital, I think.
And you wouldn't have written the book, as you say.
Really, really, I'd trade the book.
You're listening to an interview with John Schwartz, whose memoir is titled Oddly Normal. We've been hearing a lot about gay suicides and teen suicides, but you asked the question, is there really an epidemic? Is it really worse now? And the answer is...
maybe not. That the official government reports on gay adolescent suicide suggest that it's 2 to 3 times the background of teen suicide. And there are a lot of studies that suggest that is the case, or that it's higher, 5 times, 7 times more. The problem is these are very hard statistics to find. People don't ask sexual orientation at the morgue. There's no gathering of statistics. You can do surveys in which you ask people whether they've considered suicide and what their sexual orientation is. It's very hard to get a hard number that works. And some researchers have gone into this community of kids and then tried to find what their rate of suicidal ideation is and whether they've tried suicide. And some of these studies have suggested that the numbers are really not much worse in one particular study than the rate of suicidal ideation among urban kids. Well, that's not suburban kids. It's a group with some problems on the way in, potentially. But however inconclusive this collection of studies is, you can't merely say that the suicide rate among gay teens is super high. But to me, a slightly higher rate, a doubling, is too high. And to me, one kid is too many. And if that kid is Joe, it's really too many.
How do you think campaigns like It Gets Better, do they work?
Joe doesn't watch those videos, but I do. Joe is a kid that doesn't want to be told what to think by anybody.
Maybe what you're saying is that It Gets Better isn't necessarily for the kids, but maybe it's for their parents.
Which would be great. And if it reaches some kids and they are receptive, then it's great. You know, I'm the one sitting at the computer screen watching these with tears in my eyes. Joe is not going to be that kid. Other gay kids might need to see that, and I think some do. I'm really glad that that project is in the world for whatever good it can do.
What about issues like gay marriage, the kinds of role models you get on television, including a show called The New Normal? This stuff wasn't around when I was a kid. I mean, when I was a kid, if you were gay, you were Liberace, and I wasn't Liberace. Who the hell was I? Joe has real role models.
Right. Joe has real role models. There were plenty of gays on television. They just weren't talking about it. Jim Nabors was on television, but you weren't going to find out he was gay until years and years later. So you're right. You had Liberace, who denied he was gay. It's a much different time to be a gay kid. And that's why, one of the reasons why, researchers like Rich Savin-Williams at Cornell say, look, it's just a better time. Many, many, many gay kids are not feeling this stress. And he's one of the skeptics on the suicide rate and on the sense of misery that people talk about with gay kids. And for many kids, he's not wrong. So these kids have gay kids their age on television. They can watch a high school kid on Glee. And they've got talk show hosts like Ellen DeGeneres who, if they're adolescents, have been on TV since before they can remember. So the acceptance that there are gay people, you know, in their lives, and the probability that relatives of theirs at some point feel permission to come out today that they wouldn't have felt 20 years ago, makes it, in so many ways, a terrific time to be gay. But it doesn't mean that everybody's having a terrific time of it.
You're still a gay kid in the straight world.
And you're still different. And if you're a kid prone to for those differences to eat at you, then they will. And one of the things that I talk about in Oddly Normal is the work of a scientist, Ilan Meyer, who has talked about the various types of stress of living gay in a straight world. And he talks about the obvious stuff, just the fear that you're going to get pounded, that somebody's going to shout at you. But down the scale, there are internal stresses of if you're the kind of person who buys into whatever the criticisms of gays are, if it's just the kids shouting fag in the school hallway, as in saying that's so gay, you know, that using curse words that are homophobic without even understanding what homosexuality is. So if you're a kid that's going to internalize that, you don't need a bully beating you up. You're beating yourself up every day.
Well, what I found growing up, and I don't even know if I'm past it, is there's a feeling that whatever emotions I have are fake. They're not real. Real emotions are between a man and a woman. I don't know if all of this stuff would necessarily change that if I were a kid now. Maybe it would.
I hope it does. It's our job as parents to tell our kids that they're normal. You know, that whatever normal is, they're in it.
One final question before I ask you a few New York Times questions. What is spectrum diagnosis?
Well, of course, the autism spectrum is the range of conditions from autism to Asperger's, and including things like PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. I think I got that right. And this range of behaviors has been characterized and developed over the years and has, as I mentioned earlier, been a real godsend to people like John Elder Robison, who wrote Look Me in the Eye, that in, I believe, his 40s, one of his clients at his auto shop said, "Have you ever heard of the term Asperger's?" And it opened a world to him that the problems he'd had personally his whole life suddenly made sense. And so the diagnoses can be powerful and valuable. They're also confusing and can be misapplied. And the spectrum disorders cover such a range of behaviors and conditions that the psychiatric community, in its latest iteration of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, is actually getting rid of terms like Asperger's and simply saying a spectrum disorder and letting the therapist, the doctor, work with the family to give a more nuanced interpretation to them, but to not try to slice out these smaller definitions that might misapply. There are people who scream about this. I know a psychiatrist who says, what, they don't see patients? Don't they understand how useful this is? And then there are other people who say, maybe the broader, more vague application of this with room to work within is better.
It creates individuality.
It can. I'm not smart enough to have an answer to that,
right,
but that's where it's going, is eliminating labels like Asperger's, but still keeping the broad spectrum as a set of diagnoses.
John Schwartz, a few questions about the New York Times. People have asked me to ask you questions, so let me throw a few things out. Do you have anything to do with headlines?
No. In fact, I get a lot of very interesting mail, and every day I put on my asbestos underwear and read it. Often what people are most angry about is the headline. Well, headlines are not written by the reporter. Headlines have to fit a certain amount of space. They inevitably simplify. They're written by copy editors. The Times copy editors are the smartest people I've ever met. But it's impossible to get every element of the story in a headline every time. And so headlines often, sometimes, don't reflect the nuance that you've tried to put into a story. And so people will scream at you, all caps in the email or maybe a phone call, about something you wrote. You didn't write it. You didn't write that part. On the other hand, you know, as I said, the copy editors are amazing. The fact that they get any of that done at all, the fact that they get close, is this daily miracle.
The complaint I get regarding it, of course, is that the headlines tend to be more he said, she said, balanced or sitting within conventional wisdom than the articles necessarily.
It could be. I encourage people to actually read the stories they complain about.
Good luck with that.
And by the way, when people say, why does the New York Times never write about this, or the New York Times will never write about this, one of my great joys is finding the recent stories that have described this or discussed this and sending it to them. Then they say it's not enough.
Do you get your leads rewritten, or do you pretty much get what you want?
I work with my editors. It's a partnership. Some have a heavier pencil than others. I tend to be a little wordy, so my leads often need a little tightening. But this idea that somebody comes in and says, this isn't the way we think about it, so I'm going to shift this to give it to him, or to, that's never happened to me.
What about the complaint, mostly coming from alternative media, that you work for the corporate media? How do you view something like that?
I don't have a great answer to that, because I feel that the job the Times does is really important. Yes, it is a corporation. It is a publicly held corporation. They have stock. But to me, it's important to be part of an organization that can inform people. No news organization is going to satisfy everyone who reads it. I get letters, and I realize I'm setting up a false equivalence here, that I get angry letters from people who feel that I don't write enough like Fox News, and I get angry letters from people who feel I don't write enough like Noam Chomsky. And I'm sorry, but I'm trying to do something different.
But that's a false equivalency.
And it's a false equivalency.
But that brings up another question, which concerns something which is even scarier, which is that you can take most of the New York Times and you can take most of alternative media, and they're dealing with the same set of facts. And Fox News isn't.
I don't do media criticism. My struggle is to give the best information I can provide in my stories. And if I see something that somebody else does that I feel is working from a set of facts, not in evidence, I just take pride in the fact that that's not my story. That what I do, believe me, the hardest thing is just trying to get it right, as opposed to one way or another. And that's not very satisfying to people who would rather see advocacy one way or another. And that's where the marshaling of facts not in evidence, or, you know, using your own facts comes in. But I can't do advocacy. It doesn't fit in with how I see my work. The essence of the First Amendment is that a well-informed populace is the engine of democracy, and the press helps do that. Now, the newspapers, the pamphlets at the time the First Amendment was drafted were highly opinionated. So that's not, so I'm not going to get all priestly about this, but where we stand today and the way I do what I do today and the way I understand what I do today is that I shape everything I learn and the opinions I develop and try to create a story that gets it right.
Does somebody check your facts?
The copy desk does a fact check in that they check names, they analyze what I'm doing. But I don't have – when I worked at Newsweek, there was a fact checker who worked on the story and went through every line with me. And every fact was touched in one way or another. That big job is up to the reporter at this point. The copy desk can only do so much, and they're great at it, and they catch – my misspellings, and if I write that that one state is to the west of another and it's actually to the east, I will gently be informed of this fact. Which, you know, whatever stupid things I do, they're amazing at finding them. But it's not the same as having a magazine fact checker going through every line of your piece the way that the famous New Yorker fact checkers just scrub through.
But John Schwartz, New York Times, about a year ago, was it, instituted a new kind of paywall. Has that been effective? Do you feel less of a money crunch over there now?
It feels like there's less of a money crunch now. And, of course, this is not something that filters down to me in any real way. We get the same corporate quarterly reports that everybody else does. They're announced by the publisher. You know, we get information and we draw from that. The paper has sold off a number of assets and built up its cash, and that's helped a lot. The paywall has turned out to be nicely successful. They've got, if I remember right, it's 400,000 or 500,000 paid subscribers, and God love every one of them. And that's helping too, because it means that you're making money off of what was supposed to, you know, what many people think is supposed to be free. But circulation is still, you know, paid circulation for the paper newspaper. People still buy it. People still buy ads, though not as many as they used to. And as I said, some of the asset sales, including a lot of the regional newspapers, have put a lot more money into the coffers of the paper. So it's sitting in a pretty good position right now.
Obviously, you don't know But at this point, from the way you're saying, you're not anticipating a new round of buyouts or layoffs.
Those are decisions so far above my pay grade that I can't even see them. I've just got no standing to even talk about stuff like that.
How many stories do you write a week? Do they try to get you to write more stories? Do you just write them when you feel them? How does that work?
The world is broken up into stories you want to do and stories you got to do.
Okay.
And in any given week, you know, I had an editor at the Washington Post when I first got there. I said, what am I supposed to be doing here? And he said, you write two stories a week. Nobody's going to give you any trouble. That wasn't a bad. That gives you 100 stories a year. That's not bad. I exceed that number by a fair amount. As rules of thumb go, it's useless. When news happens, you write. And you've always got stories going that you want to write, that you come up with. And there are ideas that your editor has as well that, you know, that you talk about and you embark upon. There are projects that can take months or even years. And then there are quick hits. I mean, when the BP proposal for a settlement first came down, it was like 10 o'clock at night. And it happened. And the news desk called me. And I said, okay, I can get on this. How much time have I got? And Renee said 45 minutes. And, and you go. So I was in New Orleans. A hurricane was coming toward New Orleans on Monday night. I got to New Orleans at midnight, and I spent the next 4.5 days covering the hurricane.
If you go to the New York Times, there's suddenly this group of about 7 or 8 stories over a 3 or 4 day period from John Schwartz.
Right. And so there are days when you'll see several, you can see 3 stories with my byline. You know, 4 stories with my book. I think I've done 4 in a day, but I think one was a brief. You know, I mean, you can see that. There's no predicting and there's no quota. There are people that write fewer than 12 stories a year at the Times, and they are esteemed. You know, Amy Harmon wins Pulitzers off of these richly researched and beautifully written pieces that that show the world of genetics in a new light. I'm glad there's no quota, because some people do their best work on that long run. And then there's guys like me, you know, who are more like Jack Rabbity.
2 questions. Do you ever want to write op-ed?
It could happen. I don't know. I write a humor column for the business section. It comes out 4 times a year. It is one of my greatest joys. I love writing pieces that are fun. But in terms of opinion writing, it's a different world.
And the other question is, would you want to write fiction?
It is so hard to write fact. It is so hard to write stories that are right. I think that fiction would be infinitely harder for me. I mean, I'd love to try. In my first book, I opened the book, which was about bioterrorism, with a series of scenarios because Michael Osterholm and I worked on it together. He's from Minnesota. He's a fantastic epidemiologist, a brilliant guy.
What's
the
name of that?
The name of the book is Living Terrors, and it came out in September 2000. And it was all about bioterrorism and how people with lab equipment that is available on the market could create terror weapons like anthrax. And Mike and I worked through it, and we realized that to really explain to people how this could come together, maybe we should do fictional scenarios at the beginning of the chapters. And so I wrote each of the fictional scenarios for these chapters of disgruntled people working on in an anthrax lab in his basement, you know, the various scenarios which Mike and I worked on together, and I was very proud of them. And we went to our editor after he'd gotten the manuscript, and he smiled brightly at me and he said, so, we know you're not a novelist.
But that doesn't necessarily mean
one can grow. If somebody wants me to write a novel, I'm available. I work nights and weekends, you know.
Now you've been covering infrastructure, and over the past decade, infrastructure has been almost completely ignored by everybody, Republicans and Democrats, except when levees break. Have you ever thought about writing something about your current specialty, because things are getting worse? This place is falling apart.
I think there's a terrific book to be done, the nation's lack of a plan when it comes to fixing, you know, the phrase that rolls off the tongue is our nation's crumbling infrastructure. it's a great book. It's a worthy book. I don't know if it's my book to write, but I am fascinated by this beat. And the more I learn, the more I want to learn.
And finally, is Joseph going to be a writer, you think?
Joseph is a writer. I just don't know if he's going to do it for a living. Joseph's a terrific writer. He's a beautiful singer. He's got a gift for acting. You know, I had a mom in elementary school say, I can hardly wait to see what this kid's going to turn out to be. And, you know, me too.
It's a good outcome.
Yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with John Schwartz, whose memoir is titled Oddly Normal, One Family Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. And if you go to the New York Times, you could see various articles on infrastructure and other issues by John Schwartz. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.